Hey everybody, on this episode of the Comic Book Exchange, we're getting up close and personal with Barbara and Brian Dillon from Fanbase Press. Let's do it.
This is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Comic Book Exchange here on Book Circle Online. This is a show where we get together every Wednesday to talk about all the great comics that come out every week at your local comic shop, maybe on your digital storefront as well. We get a chance to get up close and personal with the people behind all those comics as well. I'm one of your hosts, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie.
And I'm Lucretia Lyon, guys. You can always find me at LACRETIALYON anywhere on the internet, since there is only one.
And joining us today, usually we have Lex Michael. He's, I think he's in Florida. Is that where
yes.
he is? Desperately seeking infusions of five-star reviews there. Folks, you can help him doing that by liking us on Facebook, giving us those five stars that Lex Michael desperately needs on iTunes. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. And, of course, Lucretia's got her computer up and running, which means the chat is up and running as well. So feel free to hop in and share your thoughts about anything generally in comics or what we're going to be talking about in particular, which are going to be our two guests from Fanbase Press. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Barbara and Brian Dillon.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you.
Of course.
Oh, this is so awesome. So we're going to talk about you guys and Fanbase Press in just a moment. Okay. But usually we like to start the show with just a couple news items here.
Sure.
And one, basically Marvel Comics has been doing their big thing you may have seen recently, the Marvel yes. Legacy Initiative that they'll be doing, kind of bringing back, I guess, some of the old numbering, which is, I love that. I want big numbers on my comics. I don't want to see them constantly rebooting to number ones.
Right, right.
Are you guys excited about the kind of Marvel's idea to kind of go back and celebrate what they think is fun in comics?
For me, I'm not a huge Marvel Comics reader. I feel like I have Squirrel Girl, and that's pretty
that's
much the limit
the right
to yes. my pull list. But I'm always eager to see something new. Yes, I agree with the rebooting kind of gets rehashed over and over again. I'm not crazy about that. But I'm always trying to be positive that something new will bring a greater audience, will bring new creativity to the genre. So I will wait and see.
I'm excited about it, but I will say Barbara and I have a lot of conversations about just the comic industry in general and how to reach new audiences and what obviously the big two are doing to do that. And the weird thing about this is it feels like half like things that could work and half things that feel really old hat. And so I'm interested to see whether there is what kind of response there is to this. But I guess there's part of me that's really desperate to see Marvel and DC try some things that are really outside the box to kind of connect with fans. I feel like they keep going back to this thing where they're so desperate for those core fans that have always been with them that they're afraid to stray too far with new things because you've got to make that money that you already know is out there. But who knows what hasn't been tapped, you know?
That's right. And DC did something back during C2E2. They spoke to a bunch of the retailers and stuff, and they're basically doing an initiative where they're going to start creating mm-hmm. new characters. But the idea is, like, instead of just having kind of up-and-comers kind of try their hand at a new character, the idea is get their big-name talent mm-hmm. and maybe get people to actually really respond to these characters and hopefully
right.
they get some legs.
Absolutely.
Do you like the idea of actually if that's maybe a way we can get new characters, but we need them by having the big-name creators be able to kind of be the facilitator?
I think that that's a necessity in this case because I think that obviously while we want to give new creators an opportunity to try their hand at things and to give them a new voice to reach new audiences, at the same time from a business perspective, it's understandable that you have to have that core audience there to call upon,
sure.
to get them,
mm-hmm.
to gain their trust, to try something new. So I understand it, and again, I'll be positive and wait and see what happens.
I think it could work. I think the main hurdle with those situations always seems to be that like everyone's very hesitant to create new characters for DC and Marvel because they instantly become property of DC and Marvel. And so I don't know what the answer is to that question because obviously DC and Marvel aren't going to be like, well, here, let's start giving out rights to our characters, to the creators. But it does feel like it is a big roadblock into, you know, getting to where we're talking about. So hopefully this initiative from DC is successful.
Because I've seen so many creators, whether it be like up and coming or mm-hmm. again, people that actually already have a name, try introducing new characters into the line and they maybe last six issues or so and then
right.
they die off. So if DC tries this with their big name creators and it still kind of goes bust, mm-hmm. what does that say about it in terms of DC or Marvel? Does that mean that fans don't want new characters?
I think that they just never really give it enough time, because you have to think about, like, you know, there haven't been really any big new characters since the 80s with a lot of these comics. And it's kind of sad, but a lot of it is, you know, I guess maybe the one 90s incarnation actually came from a cartoon that was Harley Quinn, that is yeah. a notable mm-hmm. character. And it's sort of odd. And that's why, you know, maybe, you know, the best launching off place sometimes could be a different medium than the books. But, you know, then they bring them into the novels, because that seems to resonate better with fans, at least, since they've seen them in live action or a cartoon version or something. They're able to get into the books more. I think it's kind of odd, though, that we haven't seen them come out of the books since the 80s.
I mean, I guess, like, maybe the Runaways?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that might be, like, the last big ones that I can think of that's kind of really struck a chord with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I also felt like they've kind of not been treated well once... once Brian Vaughn left Marvel, sure. they just kind of yeah. floated around for just years, not really being touched on. Same thing like also with Young Avengers. For the longest time, they just kind of languished around as well. So mm-hmm. I also feel like if you get characters that also spark with an audience, you've got to do your best to kind of keep fostering and getting those characters out there.
Well, I think you mentioned also that it's similar to the television model, where if in its premiere episode it doesn't become a huge blockbuster right out of the gate, then it's often canceled. And I think that's an unfortunate thing, that we do need to provide more time for these characters to flourish, for the storylines to flourish. But unfortunately, given the business model of, you know, it has to succeed in issue one, I think that's destined to fail sometimes.
Do you think that's a real... I mean, I guess there's so much is about, like, you know, the numbers right now, especially with Warner Brothers and Disney overseeing DC and Marvel now.
Yeah.
Do you feel like we've long passed the day where you can let a series run 12, 18 issues and hopefully that it picks up a fan base?
I think, unfortunately... I mean, I think, like, when you look at both TV and comics, I mean, we seem to be in that place. Barbara and I, again, one thing we talk about consistently is how the Netflix model has sort of changed not just TV viewing, but just pop culture in general. And we have a lot of fans we encounter who... trades is where it's at for them. There's nothing that I can say to them as a comic book lover that's going to make them go month to month and pick up a comic book, or look through previews, which, you know, is even more of a necessity for pre-ordering. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I do feel like there's going to be it's going to necessitate some big changes for the comic book industry on how do we market to fans if we want to be bigger than just this isolated group who has always been here.
And I think that's the unfortunate perception, is that a lot of people don't know or are aware of the previews catalog, how pre-ordering works, why it's important for the industry. And so if a series does come out and it's a four-issue run and it doesn't succeed, people don't understand that it's because people didn't pre-order it months in advance. So they don't see that layer to it as well. So it's a greater effect on the industry.
And how much do you feel like the retailers, that they need to be involved if you're going to be introducing new characters, kind of trying to inject new ideas both into Marvel and DC? Do the companies need to really rely on the retailers to kind of really be those? Because they are basically the curators for the comic book readers.
I mean, I think it's a group effort for everybody. I think both on the marketing front for the publisher, I think the retailers, because they are the voice. They are who directly reaches the readers and new customers. But I think there's also a marketing effort towards not just the core audience who may be hesitant to pick up something new because they like what they like.
They're already buying 12 books.
So I think it's about new, really groundbreaking marketing efforts to reach new audiences that are not already there.
We're very lucky in Los Angeles because there are very active shops, mm-hmm. and I hope that that's increasing around the country. I think it is, but there's always a sort of a line to walk there, because I think part of the fun of being in a comic book shop and having that, like, back and forth with the retailer is they recommend what they think is of quality on the rack and that you should be checking out if you're not. When it's sort of demanded or decreed by Marvel or DC, it, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes there's this feel of like, oh, here's the thing that they're forcing us to buy because this is what they're selling, as opposed to the organic of like, hey, this is what's hot right now, this is what is going to engage you in a way that other things aren't. So I don't know what what the final assessment is there. But I do think, like Barbara said, it's a joint effort.
And two, I think that digitally, you know, is becoming more of a thing. And I think that that is where they need to really reach a larger audience. Because, two, you can binge read comics, like, if you're going the digital route. And two, it's a little bit cheaper for publishers and things like that to get on there. It's just a matter of making a better marketing strategy online is what I think that they need to work on. Because Comixology is great. Mm-hmm. And it's so much easier for new creators to get on there and things like that. But just a lot of people don't know about it. And Julia Noon in the chat says, I think it's hard creating a new character and get it in to reach a big audience fast. And I think that online is probably going to be the easiest way for them to get new people out there and sort of binge it. Yeah.
Well, speaking of binging, and you mentioned also, Brian, Netflix, DC Comics has announced, like, hey, we're going to be doing our own DC streaming service. Starting off, and I know Lucretia's excited about this because it deals with her favorite person to play Robin. Dick Grayson, we're talking about Teen Titans, as well as Young Justice Season 3.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which really surprised me because I thought it was going to be heading to Netflix. But now
I
DC's
coming on. Yes.
Yeah, I want to be positive. I always want to be positive, but I am very concerned about it going to a streaming-only model. It concerns me just as I remember when, was it Battlestar Galactica, Blood and Chrome, and then the Star Trek series as well. Yeah. I fear that while, yes, I think that there's a digital audience out there, I think people are loath to try a new series digitally. I feel like that's a concern, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that we're still light years away from that being the main, you know, source because cable still does exist while it is dying. I feel that, you know, doing everything, you know, on Netflix, Hulu, streaming type services, we're just maybe a few years off. But who knows? Maybe this DC one will come out about that time where that's really happening. Because, like, the Constantine cartoon being on CW Seed makes it seem a little like, you know, there's not going to be much happening, but I just keep trying to be positive.
Well, these streaming, you know, services are really interesting because they keep popping up and they're smart about it in the way that they're putting stuff that I think people like, content that people are really engaged in and like want to see, and they're like, all right, well, you have to, you know, come to the streaming service to see it, which is a good way to get people to jump on and try these things. But I also feel like you're automatically losing a certain amount of your audience who's just going to go, oh, I can't get that, you know, the same way that when we're talking about digital comics, there's a certain wall there right now that I think will evaporate eventually, but right now there's certain people that are just like, oh, digital's not for me. If it's only digital, I guess I'm not reading it. And I worry about that stuff with Star Trek, with this DC stuff, because the content seems amazing, but how many people are going to support that content? And if it's not supported emphatically, you know, how long will it last?
True. And I think it's easier for people to say, like, hey, if Young Justice Season 3 showed up on Netflix, that's great, because I'm already paying for Netflix.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's so many other things that I can choose from, but now there's only, like, really two things to at least launch them. Is that really enough to want people to spend whatever price point they're going to be labeling it at?
Maybe if they did something like I've subscribed to HBO Go right now, and we have Hulu and Netflix, which is, in general, I think is a lot to have. But what I do find keeps me as a subscriber is that there's all this back content that I can access. Yeah. And so I feel like that's would be the real key. If DC launched something where they're like, not only are our new shows going to be on here, but you can access like every episode of Batman the Animated Series or some other content that you're like, you know what, I haven't been able to get that, it's going to be available all here. I think that would really encourage DC fans to be like, oh, this is something I need to have.
Or even all of the animated films. I mean, they're really amazing content, so I think that would be great to have on there, too.
To me, I think their best bet is to put a lot of the stuff that they own that may be harder to get places. I mean, Batman the Animated Series is thankfully on Netflix, but they have a lot of, like, animated movies, per se, that aren't really readily available, or, like, old-school content, like the 90s Flash. I mean, how many people would like to go back and watch that? Because they don't own the DVDs like some people. and Julia in the chat brings up a good point. Anyone outside the U.S. actually gets screwed by the new streaming services because a lot of them aren't available outside of the country.
I had no idea. That's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That is disappointing to hear about that. Because, speaking of, you mentioned the DC movies. I know you on Fanbase Press, you did an interview with James Tucker for the Jewish contract. Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to see it while you were down at WonderCon?
We did not. We didn't get a chance, but we just recently picked up a copy. We have to sit down and check it out. Everyone said it's really fun, so I can't wait. And the cast was over the moon about it. So.
We did get to see, what was the previous film that came out?
Justice League Dark is the last
Which
one we
phenomenal.
Saw.
Yeah, that was good.
It was
good.
Amazing, yes.
Did you guys go to the premiere here at the Paley Center?
Yes, we
yeah,
did.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
Oh, oh, nice. We'll have to look for you next time.
Well, yeah, so talking about going to events, things like that. So Fanbase Press.
Yes.
Well, let's learn your secret origin.
Okay.
What's your secret origin, guys?
Sure. So we're both East Coasters originally.
Yes.
We've been in L.A. for about 12 years now, I think. And we have, with our friend and former colleague Sam Rhodes, we founded, it was previously known as Fanboy Comics, and we founded it in 2010. And we started publishing graphic novels and published mainly our own content at the time, written by Bryant and Sam. Given the success of those first books, we started receiving submissions for other comics and graphic novels. And we've maintained for the past 7 years a submission-only process, and we work on creator-owned books all the way. Because we want everybody to create their own characters, to have their own voice, and to maintain the rights and be able to succeed from there. Yeah.
And so while we were waiting for that first graphic novel's art to be completed, one of the things that really changed the look or sort of, I guess, model of our company is a friend of ours recommended, oh, you need to be building content for an audience to build while you're waiting for this art to be produced. And we started doing reviews every week of comics or movies. That quickly led to some interviews with local creators. And then we got really lucky. And during the first season of The Walking Dead, a friend of ours ran into John Bernthal in the airport and said, hey, I have some friends that would love to interview you. And that was our first big interview that sort of got the ball rolling for, like, other press contacts.
Yeah, and since that time, we've really built an audience One of the big proponents of our company has been to, or tenants of our company has been to support other creators. We love giving a voice to people, giving a platform for those that may not have the opportunity to share their work with others. So in addition to still doing reviews, interviews, we have a whole podcast network, and we just love supporting other people as well as our own creators.
Yeah. Now, in terms of your entry point into comics, you said you're not a big Marvel person. So
yes.
Did you grow more up on indie comics?
Actually, my first comics were Barbie comics.
Sweet.
I grew up at my dad's. It was sort of like a mom and pop convenience store, and we had the old spinner rack of comic books, and we'd get like maybe 10 comics every month. And Barbie and Archie, we got an occasional X-Men comic, but never like every month, so it would be like really random issues. So those were the main three that I was reading to start, and then I loved the X-Men animated series, and that just got me going from there.
It's a pretty amazing animated series.
How about you, Brent?
I got really into comics. I had a few like Superman and like Batman issues that I, you know, like Barbara, were just like random issues, but I think I got really into comics when I got bit by the alien bug, funny enough. I got really into the alien franchise when I was in like fourth grade, and when someone, like a classmate, introduced the idea that there were Dark Horse alien comics, my mind was blown because I'd just been watching these VHSs over and over, and that introduced me to my local comic shop, and it was just, from there I was going once a week, if not more, and buying all sorts of sci-fi and licensed comics, and that just opened the world into things like, you know, eventually Spawn and Preacher and some of the Marvel and DC world.
That's actually one of my, I studied illustration in college, and one of my teachers was the person who drew the first Aliens comic that Dark Horse did, Mark Nelson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was always cool to be able to see him, show off his work and stuff like that. Oh, wow, that's really cool. But then he also, like, ate pizza a lot, and he always had pizza sauce underneath his fingernails. So I was like, it was like the really highs and the lows, like, oh, all right. Highs and the lows, like making comics.
Making the sausage.
That's right. So then what made you decide to leave the East Coast and come out to Los Angeles? Was it comics, or did you have any other aspirations as well?
We had some professional aspirations.
Yes.
I had gone to school for acting, and I came out here to pursue a film career, and Barbara was actually going to law school at the time.
Yeah, I came out here to attend law school, and the goal was always to work in entertainment. My mission in life creatively has always maintained the same thing, in that I love helping creative people. My older brother is an actor. All of my friends have always been performers of some kind in theater, film, TV. And so after attending law school, I worked in Hollywood for a few years for a few talent managers and producers, mostly comedy folks that worked with like Jim Carrey, Will Ferrell, Judd Apatow. And then we both worked in Hollywood for a bit, and then we left and started Fanboy Comics, which is now Fanbase Press. So, yeah.
it was Hollywood just like not as much fun, and you did the idea is like, why don't we create our own content that we can have total control of?
Yeah, it was the kind of thing where we still have, I guess what I would say is, certain contacts or places in Hollywood that were like, oh, we cherish this person or place. But but it was a sort of an awakening. I think we expected there to be some of the stereotypes that you hear when you're not in Hollywood to be real, but some of them were so to the T that we were like, I can't believe this world that we're living in. There was also an aspect, at least for me as an actor, where I was getting a part here or there, but I'd show up on set, and coming from a theater background, it was drilled into me to be very punctual, be on time, be prepared, and it just took one individual, whether they were in the cast or crew, to kind of cancel out the day for the rest, and that got frustrating. So we started talking with Sam and a few other creative individuals that we had known from back east, and we were just like, we can put the same amount of time and effort into our own projects, and we'll own them. We'll know that, if someone's not showing up on time, we can actually call them and be like, hey, where are you? we really decided to go that direction, and we started off with short films and quickly fell into comics sort of by accident.
Do you enjoy just the medium of comics because you get to control everything as opposed to worrying about the actors, the crew, all the lighting? It's like this, there's no budget involved, there's just what you can create in your imagination, whatever you can convince your artist, yes, you really need to draw all this awesome stuff in the crowd scene.
I've produced a number of things, theater, film,
web series,
and now comics in a way. As the editor, it still feels the same to me. There are still the same number of different facets that need to be controlled and on a timeline and on budget. So it's, for me, it's just the love of the medium itself, and the community, I think, is a huge part of it. It's just such a, not that I have any ill will towards film and TV. I still absolutely love theater, but there's something wonderful about the community of comic book creators that, as a comic book creator, you kind of know going into it, you're not going to make millions of dollars. But that really means that the people who stick with it are in love with the medium, and they wouldn't see themselves doing anything else. And so I think that's what really sticks with me.
It reminds me of my experiences in stage theater. And I would go with the community aspect totally. There are moments. You're not necessarily going oh, we sold $1 million today. But there are moments that are just moments of, creative gratification that are really present in the comic book industry. And it can be as simple as, I met a hero of mine, or we had someone come up to the table and express how much this comic or something we said at a panel meant to them. And those things are such a payoff for us, and we're so much the mission of what we're trying to do, that I think this just seems to be a world where there are a lot of like-minded individuals. And, Hollywood is just a little more, it's going to be a little more corporate, a little more sharks in the water, I guess you would say. And we feel at home in the comic book industry. We very often look at each other and something that we're doing here makes this feel like this is where we're supposed to be right now. What could be better, really?
Now, as you're mentioning aliens earlier, I did not realize that 4/26 was Aliens Day.
Yes.
Happy Aliens Day.
Yeah.
I
found there was National Pretzel Day, and I was more excited. I was like, what? I get a free pretzel from Want Some Pretzel? I did not realize it was Alien Day.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, man.
And Frank eats food. That's his Instagram.
That's it. Yeah. I'm all about that food. Yes.
it's only officially the second Alien Day, I believe. Ooh. So. It's a new holiday.
It's a new one. All right. Yes. Very new. And I did see your the article that you wrote about why they need to reboot Alien versus Predator.
Jeez. Oh, yeah. Boy, do they need to do that. I apologize to any fans out there who really enjoy the AVP film. But for me, someone who grew up in the comics, it was such a shallow adaptation of what could have been. And now that we're getting Alien films from Ridley Scott for the next 6 years or something like that. We have all these cinematic universes. I don't see any reason why we can't get a big budget Alien vs. Predator film that's, set in the future and is in all its big screen glory. So.
And maybe throw Archie in there.
Yeah, why not? Why not? I read that series. Yeah.
So I assume then, May 12th, then you first in line?
I won't be first in line, but I'll be very close. I will say I took a hit with Prometheus. I have tempered expectations for Alien Covenant, but does look very, very exciting. So you go in with fingers crossed.
Yeah, Danny McBride is going to be in it, and that excites me. He's one of my favorites. I'm like, if he is in a movie, I'm going to the theater. I mean, and then mm-hmm. to have add space, which is also another requirement for me to go to the theater, I'm like, all right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a definite must-see.
I would agree.
But I agree with what you wrote in there, because I feel the same way about Prometheus. There are just some shots that are just, they really stick with you.
Mm-hmm.
That it, even though the film frustrated me on so many levels, mm-hmm. that it's still, I will go back and watch it, because there's just so many little cool elements in there.
Well, I feel that way about all the aliens in the Alien series. I guess aside from the AVP films, I feel like they really chose really visually interesting directors. Mm-hmm. Whether they succeeded or failed in your mind, they were trying to do something new with the material each time and add something to the mythos. And I just would like to get back to that place. I feel like we really see Marvel and Lucasfilm under the, you know, under Disney building things that will last for decades, and they're putting a lot of money and talent and time into making sure these films come out correct and connect in the ways they need to. And, you know, I don't want to mention specifics, but we see other films being rushed out and they're just not as successful. They might be forgotten in a few years. And with something like the Alien series, I feel like if you've already got that built to a certain degree, don't start, like, you know, you're building a brick wall and all of a sudden you start using styrofoam. You don't do that. You know, you build it to last, and you'll be able to milk this cash cow for years, and fans will get what they want. Really well-told, interesting stories.
Mm. Do you think they made a mistake in Alien 3, though, killing off Hicks and Newt? I always feel like that was... Like, doing that just kind of ruined everything.
We are, and I'll let Barbara speak about this a little bit, we're sort of the out... I guess what would you consider us? Sort of the outsiders? Because we really
rarity.
Love Alien 3.
That's my favorite.
Really?
Film. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The dark tone of the story. I love David Fincher, but the dark tone of the story and the performances. I usually gravitate towards stories like this. If you're looking at the book series of The Hunger Games, Mockingjay, the third book, is my favorite. And it's usually the most dour, but for me, it's the most honest and genuine. And sometimes I feel like you get the most incredible stories about characters and what they go through out of those stories. So that's my favorite.
Yeah, I agree, because I love David Fincher. I actually really like Alien 3. I don't like that they killed off Hicks and Newt, but other than that, like, I think it's a great movie. And David Fincher's just way of storytelling, and like you said, the darker the better sometimes, because it's very honest. It's like, I like Buffy season 6, but then I get hated on the internet for saying that.
no judgment here.
Well, and the death of those two characters, I think it's supposed to be painful. It's supposed to be have a huge impact, but I think where I've accepted it is I'm okay. The death seems meaningful to me because what they're doing is telling a story about Ripley at that point, and it's very much like, what do we do? It reminds me of Buffy season 2, where they're like, let's strip this character down, let's take all her allies away and put her, you know, in the toughest position, and who is she at that moment? And I really feel like that's what we get with Alien 3 that's really satisfying for me, is you see your hero go through essentially hell, and she's confronted with an enemy, the company, that just can't be defeated, but she's willing to essentially throw herself in the gears to make it stop for just a second, you know, and I appreciate that message.
So what are you hoping to see out of Alien Covenant?
You know, I think we're going to see the alien be scary again, which is really exciting, because I think that there has been a lot of mystery taken away. I hope they don't take too much of the mystery away in that regards. But if we can see characters who follow reasonable motivations, I guess, you know, and get that paired with the great visuals and scares that Ridley always manages to accomplish, I would be satisfied with that. You know,
and don't kill your character by having them just run in a straight line as a spaceship just
don't
rolls
run away from a tire.
So now getting back to fan base press. So you release your own material, and then what's it like when all of a sudden other creators are sending you their own submissions? What's it like when you first get that first submission?
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, it's such a wonderful feeling that people would trust their vision, their creativity, just really bearing their soul with you. And so the big thing for us is that being that we are a smaller publisher, we can only release so many titles per year.
Sure.
The big thing for us is that we are very upfront with people. If we're not able to publish their book for any reason, we are 100% committed to helping them, giving recommendations for other publishers that might be a good fit fit for their content. If they're interested in self-publishing, answering questions or guiding them through the process. Like we mentioned before, providing promotional assistance. So we really just want people to be able to do what they love creatively and to give them an outlet to do so. And even if we can't do so directly, provide the opportunity where they can have that opportunity.
Now, these submissions, because look at some of the on your website, you've got the Gamma Gals, you've got how was it? Kinsei.
Yep.
Yes. All right. Which this one sounds awesome. When I was reading this, when you've got 1 year of superpowers, that's awesome.
Yes.
That is really cool.
Thank you.
15 issues for that. I'm excited about reading that. So when you see something like that, at Kinsei, which was 15 issues, mm-hmm. is that what your goal is, to tell stories that have a beginning, middle, and end?
We do like to have not only standalone stories, but stories that do have a conclusion to them, rather than being open-ended. For me, it's, and correct me if I'm wrong, but for me, it's really about just like the films that we enjoy. We want, or the any medium, we want to see characters that are realistic, that are enjoyable, that are memorable, and stories that are resonant. We wanted to connect with people. So, Kinsei came to us actually from one of the creators with which we had previously worked on Penguins versus Possums, Sebastian mm-hmm. Kedlecik, and he brought us this story about Lupe, who is a girl who is having her quinceañera, and she discovers that she gains superpowers, but she mm-hmm. only has them for a year. And the amazing thing was that in working creatively with Sebastian, as well as writer Kit Steinkellner and artist Emma Steinkellner, we all kind of mutually decided that we need to release this book both in English and in Spanish, because to coincide with the story and to reach a greater audience, which is always our purpose and our drive, we just felt like it was an absolute necessity with this story.
Now, as the editor for this, when it's being released in English and Spanish,
yes.
do you read Spanish?
Well, we actually have a wonderful translator, Valeria Trinier, who we work with, and she provides us with a transcribed version, and then we Emma goes in with Sebastian. They reletter everything. Every issue comes out in with both English and Spanish transcription, and I go through, make sure all of the copy editing is done, proofreading, and I can read solamente un poquito, but enough that I can make sure that yes, everything is correct. Yes.
And for you, what do you think has been in terms of resonated with audiences more? Has it been the English or the Spanish version?
You know, maybe. I don't know yet, honestly, because we're honestly still waiting for the digital numbers to come back in. But what we have seen at cons, I think, is. The concept itself, I don't know if there's specifically, like, whether it's Spanish or English that, appeals to them, but the concept appeals to people all over. I just feel like, especially young girls really light up at this concept, because I don't think there are a ton of female superheroes out there. You know, we hear about how often there's only a certain amount out there, and the weight that's sort of put on them to represent everyone. And this story, I think, also is such a—it's got such a slice of life aspect. It's really got—I've talked to the creators a little bit. It's like a Buffy-esque, or like a Spider-Man-esque, something like that, where you have the sort of the teenage life just feels genuine and real and relatable. And I think that's really what attracts people, is that they can read a page or two, see Lupe and the words that she's saying, and instantly go like, I know this person. This is someone that I might have been friends with in high school, or would have been in a group of friends that I would have. And I really think that's the concept that is attracting audiences to it.
Because I feel like when you say right here 15 issues, mm-hmm. For me, that excites me, because I feel like, all right, then they definitely have a destination they're trying to
sure.
get to,
mm-hmm.
Rather than like, oh, it's just an ongoing series, and then we'll just see. I have an endpoint in mind, but I'm probably going to go off on a bunch of tangents
sure,
until
yeah.
then. It's kind of nice to know, like, all right, by issue 15, this is going to be wrapped up.
Absolutely.
And I can see where it gets a little bit more that, like, that sadness that you kind of like, that you respond to it and some of the stuff that you
yeah.
like to read.
Definitely. Absolutely. And it's something for Lupe to go through, and her family members as well, because you're seeing it from every perspective. You're not just seeing Lupe's story. And you're seeing a history there. You're seeing a connection with the characters. And that's another interesting point that we've noticed and taken away from readers, is that they love that there's... In in an opposite way, they love that it's not dour. There's not a sadness or a traumatic event that causes Lupe to gain her superpower. She doesn't have to lose a family member, and everyone in her family is really positive. So you get a positive uplifting story where you also get a positive representation of a family unit as well.
Mm-hmm. A superhero whose parents didn't die. That's
right?
New.
But for me, I look at also the sad part, like she's only got him for 1 year and that's
yes.
it. Like very much like a strike force moratorium kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, but she still lives. She still lives. She still goes on and does a lot of great stuff. She just doesn't have power. Oh, that'd be so frustrating to have awesome superpowers when you're 15.
Yes.
Right. Live the rest of your life
yes.
going like, if only.
I know.
It's sort of like being a child star, but a superhero. They should definitely have like a revival of this, like 10, mm-hmm. 15 years
exactly.
down the line. About
yeah.
what's up with her? We'll be curious.
Yeah, right.
So when somebody comes in, it's like with Kinsey, like how much of a hands-on do you have with helping them kind of shape the story? Did they pretty much come in what the 15 issues that they have, is it pretty much what they pitched to you, or did you kind of go in and give them some ideas and some tweaks to be able to kind of help with the story?
It differs. It really differs with every project. You want to speak?
Sure. I mean, I think one of our big goals, and again, tell me if you feel differently, Barb, but one of our big goals is to work with individuals that we really trust their creative instincts. And we want to make sure that the final product is going to be something that they're really happy with, especially given that the rights are going to remain with them. So it's important that, like, as much as it's important that it works for both, it's important to us that they feel satisfied with the final product. With Kinsey, there are some plot points that we are just allowing the creative team to move forward with and are sort of being surprised ourselves as we discover them. But the overall concept is something that we discussed with Sebastian in detail. And then as he put the creative team together, we had lots of discussions about what they were looking for, what they were looking to do with the series. And I would say, you know, we had some recommendations in regards to marketing and things like that, layout. But honestly, the art and the writing and the concept have been so fantastic for this book. I feel like I'm just, like, gushing needlessly, but this book is we're so proud of it, and the creative team is so on point with what they're doing that we haven't really had any kind of notes where we've been like, hey, you know, maybe tweak this here or tweak that there. It just seems to be all syncing really well. Now, there are a number of other projects where we're either even more involved in the earlier process of, like, putting the concept together, or we're seeing revisions of a script before it's given to the artist, and we're making little tweaks there. So there definitely are projects that we have, you know, notes to the creative team. But I would say we sort of reserve, to give like a peek in, we sort of reserve any kind of like, you know, line in the sand for something that would be that important. In general, what we like to do is say, hey, this is what we think. We would suggest this. And allow the creator to sort of have some time to have a dialogue with us if they don't feel that way. You know, usually either they'll go, oh, yeah, that makes sense, or we'll have a longer discussion and come to an agreement going one way or the other.
Now, talking about creators, do usually the writer and artist come together as a package, or is it more often just the writer and you help them find an artist?
It's, again, been a little bit of both. Sometimes we've paired together creative teams. Sometimes they come together. Sometimes it's one person. In the case of Hero Hotel, Yehudi Mercado is both the writer and the artist, but he brought in a number of wonderfully talented guest creators. We've done everything from DeviantArt to Craigslist to find creators.
That's
so it really just differs, and it also depends on if the story is coming to us solely from the writers, you know, and we're looking to add a creative team to it with the artists, the letterer. I know that we've worked quite a bit with Oceana Ransford, who is a letterer
yes.
and graphic designer. He lettered one of our first graphic novels, The Arcs, but he's also designed many of our mastheads for other graphic novels, and he designed our new logo for Fanbase
yes.
Press. So once we find people, we like to keep them close because there's a reason that we choose them, and we really respect and value their artistic creativity and just enjoy them as people as well.
Man, that's interesting, like posting on Craigslist for an artist.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I haven't done that since the first couple years, but that was the initial way to find artists.
Yeah. That is how we got in here.
That's true. So sometimes Craigslist can be good. Yeah. Yep, that, all right, I can't appreciate it on the Craigslist.
You never know what's going to find on Craigslist.
Exactly.
There's always a little gem.
A little bit.
That's right.
We're Craigslist Diamonds and the Rough Guys.
That's right. Yep, that's right. So now, in addition to doing this, one other thing, too, is you also do some podcasts as well.
Yes. Yes.
What is on Family Ties?
Yes.
That is awesome.
So, you talk about that.
Sure.
One, yes.
So we have four podcasts currently on our network. One is Quality Time with Family Ties. It was pitched to us by my brother, Paul Packler. He is the biggest Michael J. Fox fan in the entire world. He is his role model. He is his everything. And we grew up watching Family Ties, Back to the Future, oh my gosh, everything, Doc Hollywood, anything with Michael J. Fox in it, we watched it a million times. Midnight Madness.
Oh, first movie. Yes.
It's amazing.
Yep.
So he pitched that he wanted to revisit every episode and do an in-depth analysis, not necessarily just a review show, but they go really in-depth into what the political climate was like at the time, what the writers were going through, absolutely everything. And they really break down each and every episode, including the Family Ties movie, which may have been the worst thing I've
ever
seen.
Made for TV.
There's that cool stunt sequence where he goes and he jumps on the bench to tackle the guy. Look at him go.
It's
yes.
Terrible.
Yeah, they get involved with spies and everything.
That's right.
Yes, but he co-hosts with Corey Pepper and Scott Jones, who are absolutely wonderful, and they're in season 5 right now.
Yeah, season 5.
So, but we also have, the Arkham Sessions, which Dr. Andrea Letamendi and Brian Ward analyze every episode of Batman the Animated Series. Oh. And Andrea analyzes it from she's a clinical psychologist, so she analyzes every episode from that perspective.
It's very interesting.
We also have the Fan Base Weekly, which is our weekly podcast where we discuss geek news. And lastly, we have Tread Perilously, where every week they take on the worst episode of really popular series and determine if that was the first episode they had watched, whether they would have watched the rest of the series.
Because I know they did one for a couple from Doctor Who recently.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but the one they did was at the was a Tennant and Donna meeting.
I think
for
Partners
the first
in
time.
Crime.
Yes,
yes.
Is that the most recent?
Yes.
And they're in Tread. Is it Tread Safely?
Tread Safely,
which is the reverse.
Mm, exactly.
It's like these are good episodes.
Yes. where are they watching these Family Ties episodes?
They used to be on Netflix, but I think they now have all of the DVD sets.
Netflix dropped out on them in the middle of season 3 or 4.
They have
the DVD set.
Yes. I know. I had to go buy all of Married with Children and Chuck when they took it off Netflix, too. Because you got to have them.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
You'll look in a bookshelf and see all the episodes. What a treat. So I assume once they finish the end of this series, is he going to continue just with his love of Michael J. Fox and talk about those other projects?
Really good question.
I don't know.
Yes.
I'm curious what you're going to do next.
Bright Night.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting. I could see them continuing on the series, or there might be a wrap-up of Quality Time and maybe something new will be on the horizon for
like
them.
Spin City.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I love Spin City.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Anything Bill Lawrence did was wonderful.
you're also doing reviews, editorials as well.
Yes.
And so how does that work with people? Do people kind of just reach out to you like, I've written this article about something?
We have a whole staff. We have staff and contributors of, I'd say, about roughly 30 people all across the country, one in Singapore now. And we work with them based on their schedule, and they're unpaid workers, so they do this out of the love of reviewing things. We, of course, give them free advanced content, whether it be comics. We have people doing theater reviews, books, video games, absolutely everything that can be considered geek content, because we just think that everyone is a fan of something, so we want to celebrate fandoms of all kind. But they really just kind of either we send out advanced review content for them to review, or we get a lot of submissions from independent creators, especially who would like their comic, their book, what have you reviewed, so we will offer that content to them as well. But sometimes they will bring content to us. We don't really do a lot of people outside of the company submitting articles for posting, because we do like to build a safety that when you come to Fanbase Press, you know what to anticipate, you know what kind of content to they will be getting. But one of the main things that's really important for us is that there's a positive bend to everything. Not necessarily that every review has to be positive and everything is good, but we do want to stick with the idea that we are here to promote creativity. We are here to foster creativity for creators, so we in no way would want them to take away a negative review that doesn't offer some type of critical analysis or help to them that would inspire them to keep going.
We're going to be constructive, and we're, you know, there's enough sites out there, I think, that are looking to do the slam dunk, if you will, on things that they think aren't up to par, so we try to avoid that. And I would also mention, we work really closely with our editorials manager, Michelle Brittany, who puts together basically our editorial content. She really guides us with, like, events that might be coming up, movies, whatever's essentially going to be in, you know, the pop culture zeitgeist, and kind of coordinates that with Barbara and I and the rest of the contributors to see who is excited in contributing to the editorials.
So the way you're talking about this, like, you know, we've got 30 contributors all around the world, in Singapore. Would you imagine when you first moved out here and had this idea that you'd be running this kind of operation?
Not
right
at all.
No, none whatsoever. But it's wonderful. As hectic as it is, Bryant and I both work full-time day jobs and manage the company in between. I wouldn't be happier doing anything else. I absolutely love it. As exhausted as we are, you know, working 3 a.m. trying to get a review done or, you know, edit a book, it's really meaningful work, and we're helping people do what they love, and we're putting new content out there that can reach new audiences.
Well, and I personally, for me, it's a real dream come true, in a sense that I didn't really know that I ever had this dream, but once we've gotten to this point, this is the exact kind of website that I would want to go have had visited in high school or something. You know, you can kind of get everything there. They're creating their own content. You know, we're putting out a sort of environment where there's a lot of free content to just enjoy from, you know, various fandoms, and it's just like a fun place to be geeky and meet geeky people. So yeah, I never expected it, but I'm just like Barbara. I couldn't be happier with the outcome.
And in addition to that, you're also actively at conventions. In fact, that's where I first met you, Barbara.
Yes.
We're there at
yes.
WonderCon. So how many conventions a year do you folks do?
Oh, last year I think we did about 12, but this year,
are we doing more now?
Probably closer to 20. right now it feels like for the past few weeks and the upcoming weeks, we will be at a convention every weekend. But it's wonderful. It's exciting. We just went to Silicon Valley, Comic-Con
yes.
in San Jose.
Had a great time there.
Met new audiences. It was wonderful. And we love being there. I mean, that's our element. And we love being there and meeting new people and meeting new readers and helping other creators who have questions about the creative process and want to start becoming their own creators.
Are you going to HeroesCon?
We are not.
I've always wanted to go there. I always think that would just be. I've always heard like so many cool things about that convention. I was like, I gotta go there at some point. That in Emerald City.
Yes.
Like
yeah.
I want to get to Emerald City one day. There's a lot of C2E2. Apparently, was fantastic the last weekend. So I mean, there's a lot of conventions that are sort of on our checklist.
Yeah. I guess and certainly the nice thing for the two of you is that you're both passionate about this, as opposed to just it's one person's and my partner is not really involved and supportive, but they're not involved.
Right.
But now you both get to be there and support each other for this, which I have to imagine makes it much more enjoyable. Enjoyable and easier at points.
It does. I mean, I think there are times where it's more trying because your personal life can very easily get intertwined with your business life, and sometimes that's difficult to separate. But there are so many advantages to always being able to sort of be on the same level with what's going on in regards to the business and sort of work in environments that would be sort of weird or awkward, I guess, to work with someone you weren't in a relationship with. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of benefits. And for me, what is, again, like sort of mind-blowing and sort of a dream come true is to be able to share things that I, for so long, sort of kept hidden from the world. I can go right back into high school and think about how I used to take the, you know, Star Wars RPG book and turn the cover inside so no one knew what it was when I was walking down the hall, or like stick the comics in between, you know, my binders. And, like, now you go to a convention and the world has opened up. I mean, I think we still have a lot of things to get through. I mean, there's many people that still feel underrepresented or feel like they're sort of got gatekeepers in front of them. But there are so many individuals at conventions and in geekdom that just weren't there a few years ago, or at least felt like they might have been interested, but they didn't feel like part of it. And that's really exciting for me and just... I don't know. I love going to these conventions and seeing people that probably felt exactly like I did. Like, oh, no one else is this geeky, just me. And now we really have inherited the earth to a degree.
The geek will inherit the earth.
So as we're getting ready to wrap up, what are you folks working on right now and the rest that you want that you can talk about?
Sure. So we have released thus far issues 1 through 4 of Kinsei, and so we have many issues to come, and we're sticking with the Kinsei theme for that series, so it's 15 issues. They come out on the 15th of every month, so that's easy to remember. Cool. The Gamma Gals, we've released issues 1 and 2. It's a 4-issue series, and then we'll be collecting it into a printed trade later this year with 2 bonus issues. And we are also working on a graphic novel called The Margins, which the story is truly phenomenal. The artwork is incredible, and that's going to be coming out next year. What else are we working on?
We also have, I think one other thing, but that is a novel that we're currently adapting into an audio drama. We have a little bit of a background with audio drama. Barbara and I were part of a group that, before the Hunger Games films came out, we ended up adapting the entire 3 novels into an audio drama, 70-plus episodes that were released free online. And so after that experience, we decided to take on something that was an original work, and we're doing a post-apocalyptic action comedy that's sort of in the vein of Big Trouble in Little China meets, like, Firefly or Mad Max. A lot of weird characters, a lot of fun, a lot of action, and a life-sized version of chess where you fight to the death.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Please tell me there'll be a guy, just that guitar player, just shooting fire, just that guy.
We'll definitely include one of those.
All right, yeah, that's right. Like every post-apocalyptic film or drama needs that guy.
Exactly.
He's too awesome. So, Brian, Barbara, first of all, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
But if they want to keep track of you guys or Fanbase Press, what's the best place to find you on social media?
Sure. Well, you can find us at fanbasepress.com, or you can find us on Twitter at fanbase_press. You can find us on Instagram, MZ, iTunes, YouTube, everything but MySpace.
Friendster guys.
We head back to that. And then you can find you guys at Alien Covenant. Maybe like a day after it opens.
Anywhere there's an alien, I'm somewhere
Bryant
around.
Will be there.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Book Exchange. How time flies when we're talking comics. But the fun doesn't stop here. Just get started. You can follow us on Facebook. Give us those 5 stars on iTunes. Lex Michael desperately needs those. He's counting on you folks. Don't let him down. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at the following handles. Me, you can do that at Happy Go Jackie and Lucretia.
And since I'm Lucretia Lyon, guys, you can always find me at LACRETIALYON anywhere on the internet, since there is only one.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, big thanks to Barbara and Brian. Thank you for coming in. Check out Fanbase Press. Check out Kinsey. I'm so psyched about that. I'm going to go check it out. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Book Exchange. We'll see you back here next week. Until then, read more comics, guys. Just do it.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO, join the circle.